Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the NFL Roadshow on the Monday after the bulk of the Week 13 action with a big game coming up tonight. Huge, huge Patriots and Bills. Very much looking forward to that. But first, while we wait for that game to kick off, what a day yesterday. Those afternoon games in particular, slow to start a little bit, but then super exciting at the end. And I know a lot of us disagree about the way that that Ravens-Steelers game ended. But I freaking loved it for a few reasons. And before I go even further, let me just say, if you disagree, I think that that is valid. I think there is a strong argument to be made for that having been a stupid call on the part of John Harbaugh. And in hindsight, that's a particularly easy argument to make. Let me tell you why I liked it, though, and why I think it could still be good for the team, even though in so many ways on the surface, the decision did a lot of damage. First, I guess before I get to that, though, if you didn't catch the end of that game, the situation was this. Close game throughout the game, Baltimore leading the entire way until the Steelers scored with 1:48 left in the game to take a 7-point lead, thanks to a 2-point conversion to make it a full 7 points. So the Ravens need to score, and they do, with 12 seconds left. So now they're down by 6 and faced with the decision to send the best kicker in the game, Justin Tucker, out there for the extra point to tie it up and likely send it to overtime, or to go for 2 and the jugular and likely win the game right there. And Harbaugh chose to go for 2 and then called a great play. Mark Andrews open in the slot. According to Next Gen Stats, he was 4.4 yards from the nearest defender. Not a great throw by Lamar. And the ball fell just out of reach of the tight end, therefore ending the game and dropping the Ravens out of the top spot in the AFC. Two things. One, this is consistent with who the Ravens are. And if it worked, as it has in the past, we would have celebrated it and talked about how much Harbaugh believes in his team and the influx of confidence that it gives them and what those kinds of calls do to the culture of the program, much like we did back in week 2 when he made a similarly gutsy or stupid, depending on the way you look at it, call to go for it on 4th-and-1 against the Chiefs on their own 43. Do you remember this play? The one where he now famously yelled at Lamar, "You want to go for it?" As if the quarterback was going to say, "Nah, not really." Anyway, he did go for it and it worked. And they ended the game right there rather than put the ball back in Mahomes' hands with a minute left to win the game. And remember, Baltimore was at their own 43. So if they didn't get that first down, they're practically in Butker's field goal range already with a 1-point lead. That's a loss. More than likely, but they got the first down. And I thought at the time, this is going to have a positive effect on this team, one that cannot be measured. To know that your coach believes in you and will put you in a position to make the plays that you play this game to make as a person, that's what I want. I want people to believe in me so much that I feel like I can do it. Player after player after player have said that that is what they want. And yes, the analytics suggest that that approach is beneficial in the long term, too, because you can't hit the shots that you don't take, etc. So that was week 2. Fast forward back to week 13 now. Similar situation, different situation, but similar stakes. And again, Harbaugh makes the call to put the ball in his guy's hands and go for the win. And though he didn't get it, I still think that there is equity in the decision. That his players will still get that same boost. They still go into the next game knowing that their coach is going to give them a chance to make the play. He's consistent. And the benefit that comes from that is that even though Lamar didn't make it, I don't think that shatters his confidence because his coach and his teammates all say, "We would do it again." They're not going to replace him. They're going to give it to him again. He is going to have a chance to redeem himself. Which brings me to the other side of this, which is the way in which this decision didn't completely turn out to be the statement of confidence that I initially thought it was. It turns out that Harbaugh wasn't very confident in his defense. He mentioned after the game that they were running out of corners, or pretty much out of corners is exactly what he said, indicating that he wasn't sure that they could stop the Steelers in overtime, which was part of the argument that people who didn't like the call were making immediately after the game. The Ravens were the better team. They probably would have won in overtime. They should have given them that chance. In effect, he's telling us that he wasn't as sure that that would happen as we were. And it turns out Marlon Humphrey was hurt in a way that we did not know. He's now out for the season with a shoulder injury. And I know some of you are probably saying, well, wait, if he didn't believe in them, why are you talking about them being gassed up about him believing in them? I know it sounds hypocritical. I think it's different to acknowledge a realistic deficiency that is caused by injury. If you look at your guys on defense who are gutting it out and are not healthy enough to do what they should be doing, it's not a lack of belief in them to say, I got you. I'm not going to put you in that position. And remember, the Ravens had five cornerbacks listed as questionable before the game, four of which ended up being active. And then the Marlon injury happens, and who knows what else happened. And the Steelers score 17 points in the fourth quarter. And Harbaugh says, our best bet is to turn to our offensive players and say, go for it. I don't have a problem with that. And I'll say this, as a fan, that is what I want to watch. It's fun. That was fun. That's what sports are supposed to be. Take your best shot. Call your best play. Give it to your best player. Let's go. And I know it's not the same thing, but I tell you what, my son is 7. He plays baseball. He's playing kid pitch for the first time. And all of the pitchers suck. It is a walk fest. No one knows what they're doing up there. They're working through it. And there are teams that we have played whose coaches are coaching their teams not to swing because the odds are that they're going to see more balls than strikes. And it sucks to watch. And it sucks for the kids because they're not playing. They're not playing defense because no one's putting the ball in play. They're not getting better at batting because they're not swinging. It's like the opposite of the point of playing baseball at the age of 7. But if the point is to win, then congratulations because it works. And I realize in the NFL, the point is to win and it's different. But it's also sports. Go play. Take your shot. Make it happen. Bring it to the other team. Be aggressive. I remember you guys know of my connection to USC. Sorry for referencing it so much. But that was one of the things that Pete Carroll did back in those Matt Leinart, Reggie Bush years. They called him Big Balls Pete because he went for it all the time in big moments. And yes, his team was talented and that was factored in. But don't you think the times that they went for it and made it also factored into their ability to handle those situations moving forward? Their swagger, their confidence in big moments. One play. Go make it. Like the Lions did. Woohoo! Finally! With time expiring and one shot to win the game, and they got it. And you saw the emotion afterward on the field. And I know there were so many things driving that emotion, but how fun was that? I mean, except for Vikings fans. Sorry, Vikings fans. Anyway, that was one of my favorite moments from yesterday, and I will talk to Chris Burke, who covers the Lions for The Athletic, about it in just a bit with his impressions of Dan Campbell and the job that he's done there so far in year one. And I tell you what, there are not many coaches in the league that I feel more conflicted about, if any. So that should be an interesting conversation. First, though, how about that Eagles win yesterday against the Jets, who are awful? I know. So it's hard to really gauge how excited to be about the Eagles, especially after last week's loss to the Giants. But they are in the NFC mix. After a 2-5 start, they've now won 4 of their last 6. They are half a game out of a playoff spot with 2 games left against one of the teams ahead of them, the Washington football team that's currently slotted in at number 6. So it is doable mathematically for them to make the postseason. But is it realistic? And then there's the conversation about what they should look like for those games. They've got a bye this week, and Nick Sirianni has said that the quarterback job will be Jalen Hurts's when they come back. But Gardner Minshew made it clear yesterday that he is not going to make that an easy call. 20 for 25, 242 yards, two touchdowns. Dude had a perfect passer rating at the half. He was good. And also fun to watch, both on the field and off. If you haven't seen the videos of him celebrating after the game, do yourself a favor and check out John Clark's Twitter feed. It's JClarkNBCS. He's got a video of Minshew after the game, both with the fans and then with his dad, and they are both incredible. And again, so was his play on the field. So for more on that, let's break the huddle with Jeff McClain from the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Hurry up, let's go!
Two on two. Ready? Three.
Well, Jeff, we've got a lot to discuss here. First and foremost, do we have a quarterback controversy percolating there in Philadelphia?
Well, you know, maybe with some fans, maybe with some in the media. I don't think inside the building there's a controversy, at least not yet. Nick Sirianni pretty much squashed any controversy or at least talk of it from the Eagles' point of view when he said immediately after the game that Jalen was still a starter. Of course he said it at the time. And really, I think based upon Jalen's play, I don't think he's done enough to be demoted. Well, I do think Gardner Minshew certainly played well and the pass offense looked a little better with him at the controls. You have to look at the big picture here. And Jalen Hurts, this whole season was about seeing what he could do as a starter. And I think the Eagles will see this through. And it's not like there's a huge difference because Jalen does give you something with his legs. He does help the run offense. And I think the difference between the two is probably marginal, at least at this point.
I totally agree that it's the smart decision to stick with Jalen and that they need to see what they have in him for long-term purposes. But Gardner, at the very least, made this so much more complicated for them with the way that he played yesterday, used the whole field, made good decisions, spread the ball around. He looked like he'd been working with Dallas Goedert in particular for years. In reality, how much experience did he have with the ones going in?
Not much. And in fact, I asked him specifically about Dallas Goedert. I mean, I'm sure he's thrown to him on occasion over these last several months, but he hasn't really, you know, worked with him in terms of first team practice reps and getting ready for the game. So that was the first time he did last week. And it wasn't like he had a full week of practice reps because early on, you know, Jalen Hurts wanted to give it a go and they thought maybe there was a chance he would play. But as the week went along, it got to be more of Gardner under center. But I think that's also part of the evaluation, as you noted, that he didn't get what you typically would as a starting quarterback preparing the entire week. So that has to be factored into the evaluation as well. But, you know, Dallas Goedert is clearly a weapon, clearly maybe the number one or two guy on the team that should be getting bulk targets. And that hasn't always been the case this season. He still played well when thrown to, but he caught six passes for 105 yards, the second time in his career that he's gone over that century mark, and two touchdowns. And it wasn't just that he was getting open. He was also, you know, getting yards after contact.
And Eagles fans like seeing those kinds of numbers. Also, I feel like there's this intangible thing that Gardner brings. And I don't know if he would consistently bring that every week, but there's like this energy, this like influx of, I don't know, something. And you certainly saw it after the game. He's easy to root for at the very least. These videos after the game, I mean, what? With the fans? Is he like that all the time? That kind of energy?
Well, you know, I'm going basically on what we've seen from him at prior stops. It's been very difficult to get to know Gardner, obviously, because of the protocols in terms of, you know, what's going on with the pandemic. And also just because he's the backup and, you know, typically a locker room's open. You'll have an opportunity to be around him and kind of get the vibe from Gardner. But this is only the second time we've spoken to him since they traded for him right before the season. But as you noted, I mean, the stuff that's kind of spilling out from the media in terms of his reaction with fans and what he's, him meeting his father after the game and just
his
how excited
dad.
He was. Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously, yeah, Gardner, everything I've heard about Gardner is he's a guy that you can root for. And that may appeal to just his kind of blue collar look and the way he doesn't really take himself too seriously. That may appeal to a certain segment of the Philadelphia fan base. That being said, Jalen Hurts has a lot going for him as well. And the way he conducts himself, the way he handles, the glare that comes with, not only replacing Carson Wentz and what happened there, but also being the starter and the second round guy and maybe not doing well. He's an easy guy to root for as well. So I don't want to make it a Gardner versus Jalen thing, but I think both are guys that certainly are easy to root for, and whether one turns out to be the guy or not, or whether maybe neither does, certainly I think you can see a lot in both their personalities and why they've gotten to this point in their careers.
Certainly. And I have lots of questions about Jalen Hurts. I want to finish off really quickly about Gardner, though, and the first of all, that video with his dad, which made me alternately, like, I couldn't decide if I was more fired up or uncomfortable, because it was like, stop hitting him, you know, but it was fun to watch them. And it felt so genuine, their excitement. And you could sense how much the moment meant to him, but it was also incredibly weird. I was like, what is going on here between these two people? But it was a great video that John got and tweeted out. And is it true that he's living at Vince Papale's house? Like, is he just determined to become an after-school movie at some point?
Wow, that's, you know what, I didn't even know that. But yeah, as you mentioned, John Clark catch up to him from NBC Sports. He was, he gets a little, he's kind of, a sponsor with the teams, they're partners with the team. So he'll get those kind of backstage looks at what's going on. And he just happened to capture Gardner running into his father. And that maybe told you a little bit about their relationship and why Gardner is the way he is. As you mentioned, they almost seem like buddies, I guess, more than son. I don't want to get too deep into that because it was just a 30-minute clip.
Let's psychoanalyze that 30 seconds, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, the punching part, I guess. But, I mean, he was hyped. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen, like, almost like a 10-year-old boy who, just experienced that moment. But as you mentioned before, yeah, I mean, there is something that's endearing about it. The Vince Papale thing I did not hear, if you're going after for a folk hero kind of thing, Vince Papale's, as we all know, ended up being his story was made into a movie starring Mark Wahlberg, Invincible. But it wasn't just that too. I think we spoke to him after the game, and he mentioned how there was somebody, a fan, who was basically dressed up as Gardner, and he went up to him before the game, and they had a little bit of an exchange during pregame warmups. And he said originally that this guy, he was wearing a Jim McMahon Eagles jersey. And I don't know if you recall, Jim McMahon did have a period with the Eagles when he was forced into the starting quarterback role when Randall Cunningham went down. And he did well. And he Jim McMahon, as you know, is kind of like a rough and tumble guy, not exactly like your kind of prototypical quarterback in terms of his personality. And that, he became kind of a little bit of a folk hero in Philadelphia for the way he, headbutted his offensive lineman. And I think with Gardner, he probably noticed that in this fan and maybe realized the similarities between him and Jim. And now maybe you'll see that play out over the period here. I don't know. We'll see. This could be just a one game thing, because Jalen Hurts, as we mentioned before, is going to be back in that starter's role when the Eagles do come back off the bye.
Also impressive yesterday, the way they ran the ball, that really stood out to me. And the way that they were committed to running the ball. And this is something that they've been doing for the last few weeks. But Miles Sanders, 24 attempts on the ground, 3 catches. Also, he rushed for .120. They rushed as a team for .185, their 6th straight game over .175. They haven't done that since 1949. And yesterday, the fact that they did that without Hurts and without Jordan Howard and effectively without Boston Scott, though he was active, it is an impressive about face from what we saw in that regard earlier in the season. How did that play out there? How did this become their identity, considering it was so far from that at the beginning of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. And while I think there were some of us who thought they should have been like this from the beginning, you questioned Nick Sirianni as a first-time coach putting so much on the shoulders of Jalen Hurts. You wonder why they just didn't do this right away. And over the course of the season, to Nick's credit, he realized that it was just too much to have Jalen dropping back 30-plus times a game. It was too much to have all these RPOs where he's got to make the decision at the snap. And they realized, yeah, let's use Jalen more in the run game as it relates to zone reads, because that should open up things for the other running backs. But also, you look at the strength in this team, and it's probably the offensive line. So why not utilize it? Why not rub behind those big boys? And that's what you saw. It was, I think it was they had like a mini bye after the Buccaneers lost on Thursday night. And I think that was when they kind of all the coaches got together and said, hey, we got to change this up. We got to take pressure off Jalen, but we also have to play more to our strengths. We have to utilize the running backs. It was fortuitous for them to some extent that Miles Sanders suffered an injury, and that led to Jordan Howard being called off the practice squad. He's made the best of his moments. Of course, he's had this knee injury now that's kept him sidelined the last 2 weeks, but you know, Miles Sanders is a top-notch running back. Boston Scott, whenever he gets in there, does well. And rookie Kenny Gainwell, as you showed yesterday, can get you yards on the ground as well. So this has been the formula. This is why all of a sudden they kind of put themselves back in the playoff picture. They're only a half game out. And while it's questionable as to whether this is kind of a long-term answer, is if this is a sustainable system to winning championships, I think you always want to go with the best odds, and that's having an elite thrower and a pass-first offense. But right now it's working, and I think Nick gets a lot of credit for adapting to it over the course of the season.
What has Jalen Hurts shown them this season? What do you think they think that they know they have in him, and what are his deficiencies that they're concerned about moving forward?
Yeah, so I think that Jalen's had almost a predictable second season. And I think a lot of us thought it would end up this way, that he'd have his moments where you're like, oh yes, this guy, I could see it. He's going to be the future. And then there'll be moments when you're like, oh no, most definitely he is not the future. And that's been, the story of Jalen. That was almost like it was last year when he got those four starts after Carson Wentz was benched, but you knew that wasn't enough of the sample. And now you're going to have 16, 17 games of a sample, and you're getting closer to getting to that, to that decision. That being said, I just don't know if it's going to be enough for them to definitively say one way or the other. I do think that they're going to have to make some sort of decision this offseason, whether it's going out and trading for one of these top-notch veterans that could be available, or drafting a quarterback, although the draft right now doesn't look appealing in terms of getting an elite talent in the first round. You could stick with Jalen for another year and devote all those draft picks to the defensive side of the ball and say, okay, we'll try in 2023. That would give him a little more time to evaluate Jalen. But I just don't know if they're going to have a definitive answer based off this season. I know we got four more games to play here, but he's shown glimpses of what he can be when he's playing at his best. But he's also shown, as we saw in the last Giants game when he only had a 17.5 passer rating, how bad it can be when things aren't working.
Who are these top-notch veterans that they could go after?
Well, Deshaun Watson is certainly a name that's out there. Russell Wilson. I don't know if Aaron Rodgers could be available. Again, these guys have to be, the teams have to be willing to move on from guy. Russell Wilson's won a Super Bowl. Deshaun Watson, as we all know, has great talent. Of course, there's the matter of sexual assault allegations that any team that considers a trade for him will have to navigate. But those are guys that I think the Eagles would have certain. The Eagles have already explored the idea of trading for Deshaun Watson. That was something that I've been told many times over, continually throughout the offseason, that there was interest. It was something that they were exploring the possibility of. They didn't ultimately pull the trigger there, and no other team did as well. But if things start to clear up in terms of off the field, there's a chance that, as long as the Houston Texans are willing to move him and he's willing to waive his no-trade clause, that they would, I think, be willing to do it. And I think the same applies to Russell Wilson, although he's had, not his best season. But I don't think all that rests on his shoulders. And, he's had the injury as well. But he's still only 33. This was a guy that the Eagles wanted to draft in 2012. They just didn't get the opportunity to. And I think they think that if he came in here, considering how healthy he's been, the fact that they have a better offensive line on paper than he maybe has ever played behind Seattle, that he may be willing to kind of lift that no trade clause and come to Philadelphia as well.
Well, as you mentioned, there's still four games left for Hurts to leave his mark in the interim and help clear up that decision one way or the other about what to do at quarterback. They have a bye this week and then four games left and they're in it. It's crazy after the way that they started this season to be in the position that they are effectively in a place where they kind of control where they'll end up because they have those two games against Washington and can jump them potentially with a couple of wins there. How realistic is it to expect this team, if they do get to the postseason somehow, is this a team that is getting better in the type of way where you think that they could actually put it together at that point in the season and maybe go on a little bit of a run? Because I look at the teams that they've defeated this year, their wins are not against an impressive bunch. You've got a win against the Jets, New Orleans, Denver, Detroit, Carolina, when they did not have McCaffrey and Sam Darnold threw three picks in that game, and then Atlanta. So I'm not looking at an impressive win on their schedule. That could change down the stretch, I suppose, but I'm not totally sure what to make of this Philadelphia Eagles team.
Yeah, I think that, a weak schedule has benefited them, last place schedule after a 4-11-1 season in 2020. As we've seen, as you mentioned, look at the teams that they beat. They haven't been very good. The teams that they've lost to, for the most part, have been top tier teams or teams that are a little bit above average. What the NFL has done in expanding the schedule and allowing seven teams to make the playoffs is that there's probably going to be a couple teams that aren't that good that are going to make the playoffs. And I'm not ruling out the Eagles sneaking in there because, as you mentioned, they still have two games against Washington. I don't think Washington's world beaters. They have another game against the Giants. They're not very good. And then that last game against the Cowboys may not even factor into the equation, at least in terms of the Cowboys wanting to play their starters, if they already have a 1 or 2 seed wrapped up. And it doesn't benefit them to play their starters in that game. No, in terms of if they make the playoffs, if they sneak in, this team is still, I think, far off from championship caliber and even, a Cinderella run into maybe the second or third round of the playoffs. The top tier teams, if you look at them, they have excellent quarterback play in the NFC and obviously the AFC too as well. And they just don't have that right now. They have too many holes in the defensive side of the ball, I think, to kind of, as we've seen, when they've faced top quarterbacks, they've gotten destroyed. They over that one span, they had five games in which they allowed quarterbacks to complete more than 80% of their passes. I'm as far as I know, that may be unprecedented. So this team, while it is getting better, and I think offensively, as you noted, there has been improvement on Nick's part and in terms of the play calling, and I think the defense has been a little bit better as well. This team, I think, is still far off from that level.
Are they going to have Sanders for that stretch run? How's the ankle? Or what are you hearing about that?
That's a good question. He met with the media after the game, and
that feels notable.
Yeah, often when guys are banged up, and that's kind of Miles' MO. He's not afraid to get up there and answer questions. So I give him credit there. But clearly, it's something that's been bothering him. He's been playing through it. He probably re-aggravated it again. It's the same injury that kept him out for a period. Then he came back and he injured it again last week, and now he's got the bye. It's an ankle sprain. I don't think it's a high ankle sprain. So if he can get that back to close to 100%, I wouldn't be surprised to see him back out there again.
One more personnel question. Why is Jalen Reagor playing more than Devontae Smith?
Yeah, I guess you noticed the snaps as well. That's crazy. I think some of it had to do with the personnel that they were using. They were using a lot of 2 tight end and 3 tight end sets. And I guess Jalen, to get him involved, they think maybe he's a little bit better of a blocker than Devontae. Maybe, perhaps, I don't know. It kind of makes you a little predictable when you do that as well. I think he only had 2 targets, 1 catch for 7 yards. I mean, this has kind of been what's been happening over the course of this season. And when he does touch the ball, it's not for very much. And there've been mistakes as well. 2 drop passes, crucial drops late in the game against the Giants. This past game, he had made a mistake in terms of on a kickoff. He thought it was going in the end zone. It did not. It bounced in the 1. He had to run back and get it and then end up getting tackled 5 yards later. Had a muff punt. This poor kid, he's struggling. The former first round pick, and he's had to kind of hear the constant references to the fact that the Eagles didn't take Justin Jefferson, who went one selection after him to the Vikings, and you see what he's doing in Minnesota. He may be one of the top five receivers in the NFL. And, you know, he's on the roster. I mean, last week after those drops, Nick Sirianni was asked if he should bench him. He said, you know, I don't know if we have any other options, you know, and at the same time, he does have a role in this team. The role is maybe to be a decoy. I don't know. But this is also a personnel issue. You know, if they had more depth, that they had done better with some of the other picks, you look at J.J. Arcega-Whiteside, maybe they could have slid someone else into that role for Jalen. But right now, he's all they got. In terms of the snaps, I don't know. I think that really had a lot to do with just the situational football Sunday.
The snap percentages we're talking about, Rager was on the field for 68% of the team's offensive snaps. Smith was on the field for 62%. Of course, the snap percentage that everyone cares about most there in Philadelphia these days is that of Carson Wentz. Eagles virtually guaranteed to get the Colts' first round pick at this point. They also have theirs and they have the Dolphins. They're going to have three first round picks, Jeff. They can overhaul this team. I mean, how quickly do you think they can turn this around with those three first round picks? Like, how many holes does this team have? What kind of a difference maker could this draft be for this team?
Yeah, that was an impressive transition, by the way. Three first rounders, right. And with the Dolphins, the other one that's affecting where they'll pick in the first round. As you mentioned, Carson, I think he's maybe one more game of him starting, which should be enough to get him that third first rounder. You know, I think when they were stockpiling the picks, obviously you just want to stockpile picks, right? But I think it was also, you know, arm ourselves to get a quarterback, you know, whether it's through the draft or via trade. But as we mentioned before, that might not be possible. So what do you do? And is this draft strong enough where you want to expend those picks on the first round, or do you just kind of deal them and kind of push them back to 2023? And I think that may be more likely the case. There are holes in this roster, significant ones on the defensive side of the ball. They're going to need another. They want to get a premium edge rusher. That's somewhere they've often gone in the first round. I wouldn't be surprised to see them do it again. Offensive line help, that's something you always need. Even though the Eagles do have it's one of their strengths and they have depth there. Jason Kelsey's not getting any younger. Lane Johnson and Brandon Brooks are both over 30 and have dealt with injuries over the last several years. So I could see them going in that direction as well. Cornerback is another area where I don't think they'd be shy about using a first rounder. But I think if you're not going to use those picks to get a quarterback, maybe two are specifically devoted to the defensive side of the ball, and maybe you kind of push that one back to 2023 via trade.
Jeff McClain, good stuff. Big fan of your work. Thank you so much for making time to come on.
I appreciate it, Lindsay. Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back with Chris Burke of The Athletic talking a little Lions after this, celebrating their first win of the season. Celebrating, can you celebrate your first win of the season when it comes in week 13? Either way, that's what's up next.
What is up, everyone? It's Jeff Ratcliff, the host of the Rant Podcast. Join me weekdays for my unique brand of insight and analysis that will help you crush your fantasy football leagues and DFS contests. I'm also bringing you the sharpest betting angles, unique parlays, and the need-to-know info that helps put units in your pocket. The Rant, the fantasy football podcast that's on every winning lineup. Subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the SXM app, free for most subscribers.
Chris, it finally happened. I kept thinking it was going to happen. I called it last week. It didn't happen last week. And then it happened this week. And I got to tell you, I also called it on the air. I was on DirecTV's Fantasy Zone channel. And when Adam Thielen left the game with an injury, I was like, oh my gosh, it's going to happen. This is it. This is the makings of it. Now I'm going to go for it again. Lions win first quarter, put it out there into the universe. So I was very invested in this turning out the way that it was, as somebody who actually didn't have a horse in this particular race otherwise. What was the reaction like in that locker room?
Did you still think they were going to win after Minnesota took the lead in the fourth quarter?
I got to tell you, my optimism waned a little bit, but I just held on right. because weird things happen. And the thing is, weird things happen to this Minnesota team too, right? It was on brand for them to lose the way that they lost just as much as it would have been on brand for the Lions to not win if that pass had not been completed in the end zone.
Well, I mean, I think you saw the celebration on the field was pretty genuine. You know, Jared Goff ran over, hugged Dan Campbell. He was jumping up and down. The players went over to the stands and were celebrating. And guys were just running all over. Charles Harris said he tried to get down to where everyone had sort of mobbed in the end zone. And he couldn't even make it because there were so many people hugging him and jumping on top of people. So it was, I mean, I'm sure from the outside looking in, people see it and say, oh, you know, you're 1-10-1. Just relax. But that was for that team. For that coach, for that fan base, and especially this week, they talked a lot after the game about, you know, we unfortunately had the school shooting here in Michigan last week. They had the decals on their helmets. They really were playing for that team. Dan Campbell talked to them on Saturday about what had happened at the school, what was going on in that community. And so it was just, Jared Goff called it cathartic. I think it was just, there was so much emotion kind of bubbled over there. And you saw it on the field. It continued over in the locker room. Team owner Sheila Ford Hamp went down there and got a bear hug from Dan Campbell. He picked her up off the ground. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a long time coming. And you could see the reaction. They needed one for sure.
It's a building block, I guess you could say, for me. And you say that people on the outside would look at it like, settle down, you have won one game. For me, I think people who have been paying attention, though, like they've been in it. You know, there have been so many games. The thing that impresses me the most about this Lions team is how many times they've had their heart broken because they haven't just been getting stomped in every game. Like they come out there and they put themselves in a position where you feel like maybe they have a chance to win, right? The way that they played the Rams, the fact that they were so aggressive strategically in the beginning to keep themselves in that game until they weren't in that game. There have just been so many times this season where it felt like just that one extra thing. They needed that one extra thing to push them over the top. There's so much heart, I guess, is sort of an intangible generic word that I would use from the outside that I see, like there's a lot of fight in this team. I don't know if there's a lot of talent on this team or great coaching decisions happening on this team, but there's a lot of like the intangible thing that's made me root for them to get over that hump to get that win this year.
Yeah. If that finish goes the other way, I think we're probably talking more about some of those coaching decisions again today, like we were the last couple of weeks in Detroit. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think that's been the impressive thing. They're still very close knit. They're still showing up and working. You know, they're definitely still buying in for Dan Campbell. And really for, I think that one of the sort of underrated performances in coaching across the league this year probably has been Aaron Glenn with that defense, because they have just been clobbered by injuries. They're starting, you know, undrafted rookies and guys are just picking up off the street. And they've really, other than they got blown out by Philadelphia, the Rams got hot in the second half as the Rams usually do. But otherwise, they have really done a nice job hanging in these games and giving the offense a chance. And they just haven't been able to score any points. So, I think you're right. I think that this has been as impressive, I guess, a coaching performance as you can have for a 1-10-1 team, because the guys are still there and they're still playing hard for them every single week. And they have been in these games. I mean, they're a couple kicks away from having 4 or 5 wins right now. It's kind of crazy, but I think that they probably deserve to get one. I don't know if they'll get any more, but they probably deserved one.
You know, it's funny. You talk about when you say impressive coaching, it's such a, there will be people that roll their eyes when you say that because of the very glaring weaknesses that Dan Campbell seems to have as a coach, but I feel the exact same way. And I've been so torn this season because at the beginning of the season, I thought, oh, I'm in. And I didn't necessarily like the off season stuff and the biting kneecaps or whatever it was, like none of that gets me. I was rolling my eyes and saying like, come on right now, like who in an NFL locker room is buying this thing? But then the way they started playing, it felt so genuine coming from him. And clearly they sensed that it was genuine and not some sort of like weird football coachy shtick. That's just who he is. And that's how he talks. And they were buying in. And I loved the aggressiveness with which he approached some fourth down situations. again, early in the season, because I'm thinking, you know, your team doesn't have the talent. So let's put yourself in a position by just stealing extra possessions. Let's try and get that win. And I thought he was helping them put themselves in a position where they had a better chance to win than they would have playing somebody straight up. Then more recently, there have been some just glaring deficiencies in terms of in-game management and decision-making. And now I'm very conflicted because he feels very like the type of coach where the intangibles are all there. It's exactly what you want with the guys buying in and wanting to play for him. But then, you know, some of the other facets of coaching that are pretty darn important in a head coach don't seem to be there. How do you come to terms? What do you think that they think they have in a head coach?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably the next step, right? Like, can he learn from these mistakes? Can he get better in those spots? Because even in this game against Minnesota, you know, they had a couple fourth downs in their own territory. They went for it, the one in the fourth quarter where they're up by a couple points. It's fourth and one. They call a play action pass. Goff gets sacked and fumbled. And then you're sort of wondering, well, what? You know, what happened there? What was the decision-making process? Not just to go for it, but that play call there. And so I think that is probably the next step. And it's really been an interesting team to watch develop even since April, because there are so many young players and new faces and everything. But you also have, I mean, this is Campbell's first time as a full-time head coach. It's Glenn's first time as a defensive coordinator. Mark Brunell came, you know, he played in the league, obviously, but he was coaching high school football, and now he's your quarterback's coach. And you saw all these guys who are trying to learn on the fly, I guess, while also overseeing all these other things that are going on with this team. And so I do think that that's kind of the curiosity. Will it get better? And I don't know. I mean, I think the Lions certainly hope it will. But again, you go back, I think for this season, they knew it was going to be pretty rough. And so I think a lot of it was just about hanging in there, trying to establish their identity and making sure guys stayed bought in. And then whoever wasn't bought in, you figure that out too, and you get them out of there. And I think that they've accomplished a lot of those goals. And I do think you have to give some credit too, to as much as Jared Goff hears the criticism, you know, I think you've got to give him some credit for buying in and doing what they're asking him. And Michael Brockers got traded over from a contender to this team, and he's been a leader on defense. So they have some of these guys in the locker room who are helping too. I think the culture is way better than it was a year ago. And now you just kind of wait and see if that's going to translate into wins at any point.
Right. How important do you think that was in terms of the rebuilding process, changing the culture?
I mean, I think it was the number one factor in how they went about this hiring cycle. The last hiring cycle, when they hired Bob Quinn first, and then he was a year with Jim Caldwell, and then Bob Quinn hired Matt Patricia, and that really was Bob Quinn's hire. Ownership kind of let him do that, sat back, hands off. And this time, we saw how that went. It didn't work. And so I think this time the goal was to really get in there and find someone who sort of embraced and leaned into everything Detroit fan base is about. You hear all those buzzwords and phrases, and it's the biting the kneecaps, but the, you know, the blue collar, the hard work. And, you know, again, at some point that sort of runs out. You're not going to just out hustle teams in the NFL and win a Super Bowl. You know, you've got to have talent. You've got to have a good game plan and everything, but they needed to just get that locker room all back on the same page so that guys liked playing for the coaches and going to practice and all these things that just weren't happening last year. It was a very split locker room the last year or two. So again, I think they've made a lot of progress. It hasn't shown up in the record, but there's some excitement, I think, starting to build here about the offseason, because you kind of sense how important it's going to be. They need to have a good offseason to make sure that next year, you know, you get to at least 5 or 6 or 7 wins. And the year after that, you're kind of hanging around the playoff race. I think that's sort of the progression they're hoping for here.
And we talked about it yesterday on air. Somebody brought up that the Texans had the worst roster in the NFL. And I started kind of going through it really quickly mentally. And I was like, yeah, they actually are worse off than the Lions. Because at least with the Lions, you can point to DeAndre Swift, who appears to be a special talent at running back, and TJ Hawkinson, who's one of the best tight ends in the league. And then you have this building block on the line in Penei Sewell that you just brought in. Like, there are pieces there. How many pieces do they have that they are not worried about moving forward, that are the pieces that you build around as you start to look toward the future?
Yeah, well, I think going back to that idea of forming an identity, if this offensive line is healthy, and that's sort of been the talking point all year because it's never been healthy. If it's healthy and you have Stuhl and you have Frank Ragnow is one of the best centers in football and Taylor Decker's a good left tackle, they've gotten good guard play. That's really your building block. I mean, I think you can stay in games a lot of weeks with that and Swift and Hawkinson. And Amon-Ra St. Brown looks like he's going to be a good player in this league. So you start to see it come together a little bit on offense. Got to figure out quarterback, which is a big one long term, but I think you can start to see just the identity building on offense. Defense has been a little tougher because it's been, you know, Jeff Okuda got hurt early. Romeo Okoro got hurt early. They released Jimmy Collins. And so there's been a lot of moving parts. But again, you look at that side of the ball, and there's a lot of young talent that's been playing better as the season has gone on. And that's really all you can ask for. So, you know, number of pieces, they have a ton of work to do this offseason. There's no question. They need to bring in like a dozen more guys who can start on either side of the ball. But they're better off. I think they have a better feel for where those holes are than they would have, you know, 3 months ago, because some of these guys have started to show up and play the way they thought maybe they could.
I keep hearing defensive ends named in terms of looking ahead to the draft. Is that the position that you think that they would address with their inevitably high pick, whether it's the first overall pick or not? Or do they try to go quarterback? Or what do you think they think are the priorities in that sense?
Well, that they got that win, and now I think fans here are nervous because if you win a couple more, you lose that number one pick. And that's what happened last year. They won a game or two towards the end and dropped from, they were like two or three and wound up at seven. And you obviously still get seven or eight. They still get Sewell. But so now you're in that spot again. But I think if they stick at one, just looking at this draft class, I think you're right. Like the top of this class, we've been waiting for a year for a quarterback to emerge and sort of run away with it, and it hasn't happened. And I think we know they like Jared Goff. I think one of the hard things to tell is how much they like him. Like if the team is better, do they think they can win with him? I still get the sense that they do. Everything that they've said and done since they traded for him sort of pointed to a 2-year window to figure things out with him. So I don't think they're desperate to get a quarterback. And then you look at the top of the draft, if they're sitting one, Aiden Hutchinson from right down the road here at Michigan and Kayvon Thibodeau certainly jump out in this draft class and would be huge pieces for that defense. If you get one of those guys, you get Romeo Okoro back healthy, you have a couple of young interior defensive tackles you drafted, suddenly things look a little better on that side of the ball too. And you can maybe make the type of turnaround you need there.
Are people there in any way second guessing last year's draft decision? And now that Mac Jones has emerged as a viable starter in the NFL, I would argue that he would not look like that in Detroit. Yeah. Because it's clear that he's a guy that can do his job and not lose games for you, but he's getting help from the fact that he's coached by Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels, and they're putting him in a lot of positions to succeed as they have for a number of years. And they have some pieces around him to kind of protect him in that way so that he's not asked to do more than he can do.
Well, I think that that's what they think Jared Goff can be, more or less, you know, for $30 million a year, unfortunately. But that's sort of the idea that you can win with him.
I guess you could win with him, but he also makes mistakes that cost you. He's that right. type of quarterback.
Right. And as I say, I think that's sort of one of the things we're kind of waiting to see here. Just how committed are they to this guy? Because I do think, like I said, I think he's fully embraced his role here and embraced what they're asking him to do and the leadership role. And then you wonder if there's anything more in there, if this offense has some pieces for him. Because Dan Campbell said it at some point this year, it's been hard for them to judge him in this context because they haven't really had any wide receivers all year and the offensive line's been banged up. So I don't know. I do think there has been some second guessing, and you talk about not having a wide receiver. Ja'Marr Chase was a guy that they were linked to for a long time there. And the offense would look different with him in there than it does right now. And Justin Fields, it hasn't gone as well in Chicago as it has for Mac Jones in New England, but that's a guy Detroit's probably going to be playing twice a year for the next however many years now. And so you're going to see firsthand if he's really good. You know, that's when people are going to be going back to for a decade around here. So, I mean, it's always the thing. Until you have your quarterback, you're always sort of looking and wondering where else you could have gotten a quarterback. So I think that there probably is some second guessing, but Penei Sewell's been really good, especially the last, you know, 6-7 weeks. He looks like the guy they thought he could look like. And you see that sort of Pro Bowl, all pro level talent flashing every time, every once in a while. And so, if he continues to develop like that, I don't think that people will care as much because he can be an anchor for that line for years and years and years.
Yeah, that's a tough one because there's no tangible way to, for most fans who don't know what they're seeing when they right. watch O-line play, to really say, here's the way that he's affecting this game. Whereas a wide receiver, it's easy to look at some numbers. Speaking of wide receivers, you mentioned Amon-Ra St. Brown as somebody that is emerging this year as a guy that they could maybe build around at that position moving forward. The wide receiver position, and I'm looking at this from a fantasy standpoint, right? Just looking at the numbers every single week and trying to figure out who it's going to be. And frankly, there is not anybody that I actually feel comfortable playing at the wide receiver position for the Lions because it's so different from a week to week standpoint. Like there's no one that has emerged as the guy that's heavily targeted. In the last couple of weeks, it feels like it's Josh Reynolds. And maybe that goes back to the relationship that he has with Jared Goff from having played together in the past. But how would you say they are currently set up at wide receiver in terms of who is the priority, who is the one, who's the guy that's the first read that they're drawing up plays for? How does this all coming together in their mind? What do they think that they have with this group?
I think yesterday might have been a bit of a turning point for them because they have been talking for 3 months now about trying to work their passing attack through St. Brown a little bit, and they just haven't been able to do it. And some of that's been play calling. Certainly some of that has been Goff, but this game, and especially down the stretch when they needed plays in that 2 minute drill, he was their guy that they were looking for to make catches. And you kind of see, we've seen it here since the moment he got here. He stays after practice and catches 150, 200 balls every day. I mean, he's a professional. That was one of the reasons they loved him. He came in, he acts like he's a 10-year pro. And I think you're starting to see some of that emerge. The play calling here has been one of the problems, and especially sort of how it's worked with Jared Goff. And that's why Dan Campbell made the change away from Anthony Lynn as the primary play caller and put himself in that role because he wanted to get a better feel for how to use these weapons. So I think, St. Brown, to me, especially with DeAndre Swift out, St. Brown is a guy that should get a lot of targets every week. I think most of it still runs through TJ Hockenson and through Swift when Swift's healthy. Josh Reynolds has been a nice find for them, though. And you look back to the offseason, I think they signed Tyrell Williams because Anthony Lynn knew him. Josh Reynolds was there and available pretty cheap, too. And you kind of wonder how different things would look if they had just tossed him a contract in the first place. But that's one of those where, you could see him back next year because I think he does have a nice rapport with Goff. And I think he is a decent NFL receiver. So don't really answer your question because I think it is still very much a week-to-week thing, but I think Hockenson, Swift, and St. Brown are the three guys that they really, really want to try to get involved every week, and it just hasn't necessarily happened that way.
Okay, next game is against Denver. That feels winnable, though it's Detroit. So what is your best guess as far as what we take away from this game and what the Lions, what do you think is reasonable to expect from them in their next game off of this one? Is there a pattern that you know to expect? Will they be competitive with Denver? Is that reasonable to expect? What do you think?
Well, I think what we've seen in a lot of these road games, the LA one was sort of an outlier in this whole season because of how they played that first half. I don't know that we'll see a first quarter like that in the NFL for a while. So but these recent road games, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, they're playing with backup quarterback, but that was sort of what they want to do. Just control things, get it into the fourth quarter, hope their defense holds up, which I think it probably can for the most part against Denver, establish the run a little bit. So it's going to be, I don't know that the endings of these games have been exciting. I don't know how the middle, like 50 minutes of these Lions games are for people to watch, because they can get pretty ugly. And I think that's probably what they'll try to do from here on out. But yeah, I mean, Denver, they've still got Seattle. They've got Atlanta. You've got Green Bay in week 17 or week 18, maybe not playing for anything. So they still got some opportunities to pick up a couple more along the way here, but you know that they're going to show up and they're going to play hard. So they'll probably hang in there for a while.
Opportunities coming up, some of which I would imagine at a point Lions fans would start rooting for them to lose, right? Just, for the reasons that we've already talked about, such as life in Detroit. Hopefully that changes in the next few years. Chris, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
All right, that's going to do it for today's show. If you enjoyed the show and you want to hear more, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. You can also subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, wherever you get your podcasts. The NFL Roadshow is also available on the SXM app, free for most subscribers. Just download it today and tap podcasts. For video clips of the show, follow me on Twitter, Lindsay_Rhodes. I'm also on Instagram, LindsayRhodesNFL. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network. The executive producer is Andrew Emmer. Andy King is the director of sports podcasting for SiriusXM. And a special thanks to SiriusXM's senior vice president of sports programming and podcasting, Steve Cohen. We're back on Wednesday with another episode. Enjoy the Monday night game, and we'll see you then.
SiriusXM Podcasts.